Thank you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Monsanto versus Bustani.
May it please the court, Mr. David Collins, petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
If it pleases the court, there are two issues in this case, but I'm going to begin with contract construction. We have passed out to you an exhibit we were going to use for oral argument purposes to run through the option plan and the certificate. All of you know that in contract construction, the most important thing to do is determine the intent of the parties. And in this case, that is an easy situation because the parties specified the intent in the option plan. And on page 2 of the handout, we see what it is. It is the plan is designed to attract and retain for the company, and the company, by the way, is defined later in the plan as Monsanto, its subsidiaries and associated companies, personnel of exceptional ability, and to motivate such personnel through added incentives to make a maximum contribution to whom? To the company, Monsanto.
But the purpose clause works both ways, doesn't it? I mean, opposing counsel has argued that it's also a reward, which incentive doesn't preclude. And so, I mean, where does that end up?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a very important argument. And I think you have to look at what the plan later does in definition.
Well, yeah, okay. So more specifically than incentive.
I'm yes. Sure. But I
want the word to attract, too. Might I be more attracted to a place that's going to give me a 10 years to hope the market goes up than one who just gives me until they decide to sell my car?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And if that was all that was in the purpose clause, we might have a different situation.
Let's go on to another clause.
But I think what's important is to meet the objectives of the company. The important thing here is that when you look at this, all parties agree that once the options were issued, that they lasted for 10 years and could be exercised any time during that 10-year period with the exception of termination of employment. And that's the rub in this case, candidly, on the contract construction. What employment? And what termination? Now, the plaintiffs say it is termination with Fisher. We say it was a Monsanto-related company. And let's look at what the plan says. And I'll ask you to turn, if you will, to page 3 of the handout, because I think the definitions give you an example. The plaintiffs have set up on an easel the option certificate. That is page 5 of our handout. But in the very first paragraph of the option certificate itself, the option says, look to the plan for the definition of termination of employment. And here's what the plan says. It means discontinuance of employment of a participant for any reason. Participant is also a defined term. Participant means an eligible participant to whom a stock option has been granted. Eligible participant, finally, is the last defined term, and it means any employee of the company, of subsidiary, or the associated company. Again, remember, company is defined in the plan as Monsanto. So I think it is clear that what Monsanto was attempting to do here was to continue to let options stay with an employee during the time they became a participant and will remain an employee of a Monsanto-related company.
Mr. Keller, let me sidetrack you for just a second and then have you come back into this. I want to understand the context of the argument that you're currently making. If we were to decide in your favor on the issues you're discussing right now, do we even need to get into all the Delaware law stuff and conflict of laws and all that? Or if we decide this, do those other issues go away?
Your Honor, I hope you will get into them, but the answer to your question is they don't go away, but they would become unimportant. Let me put it to you this way. They're not that important. I think the court should decide it. In fact, this case really gives the court a perfect opportunity to adopt a new statute of limitations conflict rule.
But the contract construction issue is dispositive.
The contract construction.
But you're not saying it's not.
No, it is dispositive, Your Honor. It certainly is. There's no doubt about that. But again, I think it does give the court a perfect way to enact a change in the law and decide on the issue of contract construction, and we think we win that issue.
So if we say as a matter of law, the contract should be interpreted the way you're requesting the court to interpret it, case closed.
you would not have to reach the statute of limitations provision. That is correct.
Right, let's look back where you were looking at termination of employment. It strikes me that a significant term that hasn't been focused on as much is the definition of transfer. And I'm going to ask this of your opposing counsel as well, but transfer means a change of employment of a participant within the group consisting of the company and its subs. And doesn't that imply that then transfer is within the company and therefore termination of employment is without the company? Which is your argument. I'm not trying to trick you. It strikes me that that defining transfer as something within the group and saying that termination means discontinuance of employment of a participant for any reason other than transfer implies that termination of employment means outside the group. And once Fisher was sold, it was outside the group.
Yes, Your Honor. That's very consistent with what the purpose of the plan was, to benefit the company. To benefit Monsanto with all these things.
But I mean, you don't even need to get into purpose. Under the plain meaning of transfer and its incorporation into termination of employment, doesn't that lead to the conclusion that you're arguing?
It certainly does.
And I'm really giving your opposing counsel some time to think about that.
Okay.
I just want to know, I know that you don't make this argument, but if this had been a change of control of Monsanto, does that mean that stock can be exercisable for 10 years, even if there's a subsequent termination of employment? What's your position on that?
If I understand your question, is this was a change of control of Monsanto, what would occur? And that was dealt with in a completely different provision on change of control of Monsanto, paragraph 7 of this agreement, which deals solely with the change of the control of Monsanto, not of the subsidiary.
I understand that. I'm just asking, what's your position on that? Does the termination of employment still trump that 10-year provision or not?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The reason is, under the terms of 7, it wouldn't apply. 7 only comes into apply when Monsanto goes away or is disposed of.
I'm just asking hypothetically.
Yes.
Let's suppose Monsanto was merged into another company. There was a change of control of Monsanto, the company, within the meaning of the plan. And employees were subsequently, who had been Monsanto employees, were then terminated by the acquiring company. Would their stock options continue or not, for 10 years or not?
No, they would have the 10-year period under paragraph 7. They would. The point that I think we need to make to you is the only way to construe this plan and give meaning to every provision is to look at the purpose. To make sure that we understand that is, the purpose of the plan is directly incorporated into that certificate. In paragraph 10, which is the page 5 of our handout to you, you'll see the highlighted part of paragraph 10, and it says that each and every provision of the option shall be administered, construed, interpreted, so that the option shall in all respects conform to the provisions of the plan. That's important in this case because the plaintiffs take the position that you can only read the option certificate alone. And the option certificate says that's wrong. You must interpret it in connection with the entire plan. Equally important in this case, an Employment Compensation Committee, we call the ECC, was authorized and in fact directed under the plan to interpret it in all situations. And it was asked to do that in this case.
Yes. Is option E a defined term anywhere? I couldn't find it, and it seems to be used in particular in the option term provision of the option agreement and might be of some significance.
Your Honor, it is not a defined term. You read this absolutely correctly. I believe it means the only thing that it can mean is participant, because a participant, by definition, is an employee of Monsanto or a related company who receives an option. So I think those two terms are interchangeable.
What about their argument that there's a difference between an eligible participant and a participant because once you become a participant, you actually have the plan and you're an optionee? And shouldn't you have 10 years rather than being caught up in the termination?
Well, Your Honor, I think it fails for two reasons. First off, there is no provision in the contract that elevates anyone to some super additional status. You would have to
You either are eligible because you don't have an option, and then you become a participant because you do. So you're in a different class.
There's no doubt about that. But the way the
and what goes with being in the participant class that would aid their argument, or does it?
I don't think it does. Because still, to be a participant, which is defined as someone who has an option, you have to be one more thing. You have to be an employee of a Monsanto-related company. And that makes sense in the governance of the plan. You would want to define that that way to make sure that the plan applied to everyone. Your Honor, I think it's important to note as well, all the cases that have been cited to you on interpretation of these plans under Delaware law, the Beard case at the plaintiff's site, the Stimmerman case that both of us cite, virtually have the same provisions, and they limit participation in the plan to people who are still employees with the company. And that makes sense because that's the only way these people can participate in the helping Monsanto do the things that it needs to do.
The respondent in his brief says, on page 19, that the option certificate specifies that termination must be by both the company and its subsidiaries.
Did the option certificate? I disagree with that, Your Honor. And in fact, in reading both the option certificate and the plan, which I really think they're replying to, I don't believe says that. I think the issue is whether you are an employee or are terminated from a Monsanto-related company. And I think that is the only thing, again, that makes sense. And under the Delaware law, and that's the DuPont case versus Shell Oil, harmonizes all the provisions. This next issue, as you know, that we have is a choice of law issue on statute of limitations.
Well, if we could decide this on the contract, haven't you noticed in the past our courts had a reluctance to talk about non-dispositive issues?
Yes, sir, I have.
And maybe you should have started with limitations first.
Well, Your Honor, I
why would we want to change what's been seen in the 1800s, a consistent statement that limitations is procedural, that we're going to apply our laws and get into an extracurricular activity of the reviewing all of those factors that the restatement gives us to do when it's pretty simple. You just say it's procedural in 3 years, 4 years, or whatever. What's to, other than your desire for Monsanto to instill the desire to change this policy?
It is good public policy for this state for a whole host of reasons. There has not been a commentator in the last 10 years who has advocated the retention of the Lex 4i rule that we have. Three-quarters of the state in this union have abrogated Lex 4i in their common law. Another 10 states on top of that have done it by statute and the like.
Texas, you mean on limitations or total?
On statute of limitations.
Let me stop you. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. But they haven't adopted Rule 142.
Not all of them have. No, Your Honor. Three states specifically have done that. You'll notice that the plaintiffs point out that it's not exactly a big bandwagon. I disagree. What happened is when ALI looked at this in 88, and this was after a period of about 5 years of looking at the issue, they followed the trend that they saw from other states. By 1997, we know from the Simonides article that there were 17 states who had abandoned Lex 4i. There were three that had specifically adopted the restatement. And let me tell you, a lot of them have just gone to straight interest analysis of who has the most significant interest with the proceeding and with the parties as well. We thought that the restatement was a good place for this court to go because it remains consistent with what you've done in the DeSantis case in 1990 and back in Gutierrez in 1979.
With all due respect, a law professor doesn't want a rule that Judge Baker can state in 5 seconds.
And some lawyers don't either, Your Honor. If that's true, and I would have to admit that the rule is easy to apply. But this court in Gutierrez looked at the exact same rule in Section 6 of the restatement, which is the interest analysis, Your Honor. And what they said is, it may be simple, but it doesn't lead to good results, and it's not rational.
But if we were writing on a clean slate, it might be one thing. But what deference should we give to the legislative decision in 97 to enact a borrowing statute that only applies to personal injury and wrongful death claims?
Your Honor, I don't think the legislature entered this arena in anything other than the tort reform litigation. Remember, that legislation passed with the adoption of forum nonconvenience, the change of the venue laws in a tort reform statute. They looked at what you did and they made, or what the court did in applying Lex Fori. The nice thing about this is, Section 6 of the restatement, which is really the action part of 142, would allow you, in an interest analysis, to first apply the first provision, A of 6 is, you apply the statutory law of the state. So it would, it dovetails perfectly with that. Additionally, remember, choice of law issues have traditionally been reserved for the courts.
I thought you were advocating the, in your brief, you were advocating that states, once, if the courts were by common law to adopt Section 142 of the restatement, the prudent thing to do would be for the legislatures then to abolish sparring statutes because we wouldn't need them.
No, Your Honor, let me explain what we meant by that. There is no doubt that the, one of the comments to 142 says that that's one of the things you should do. The reason is not that it's inconsistent if you read the comment, as the plaintiff suggests. The reason that you would reject the borrowing statute is it's no longer needed.
Well, I thought you said one of the first things you look at, even under the restatement, is the forum state's law.
Yes, and maybe I was answering a question you weren't asking, and I apologize. What I meant to say is 6 is consistent and would not step on the legislature's toes at all in this circumstance, because in personal injury cases and wrongful death cases, it would allow the application of that law, and the rest would be taken care of in the interest analysis.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Russell Fields will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. If I could, I'd like to go ahead and start with the contract issues first. And I want to, Your Honor, I want to get to your issue about the transfer, but I think the first things that we have to do is, if y'all will look on, in our brief, under tab A is the plan, and under tab B is the option certificate. And the important highlight I want to point out about the plan under tab A is on page 9, section 4B, because we're talking about the exercise of the stock options, and that's a big distinction that I think we have to make here. Who is an eligible participant determines who's going to get a grant of stock options. But it is not until you become an optionee that we start looking at who could exercise the option. And under 4B, Your Honors, it says that the committee, first of all, it says that my clients have a 10-year option term. And it says the committee can make a shorter period, but that period has to be as in the grant, and also the triggering mechanism for that shorter period also has to be as specified in the option. And if I could, Your Honor, if I could approach the blow up here. So then.
Read it. Read it loudly and clearly, because I can't even see it from here.
I can't either.
And I apologize. If you will look at tab B, that has the option certificate. And what I'd like to show is just the points that this court needs to look at and determine. We're talking about the exercise of options. The first thing you've got to remember is this option agreement, it pertains both to Monsanto employees and the Fisher employees. It's to all optionees. And once those employees become an optionee, then this agreement.
Where does it say that?
Where does it say what? That
your former statement, they become optionees. Where does it say that?
On the front, if you look on the front, it will have, for example, in this case, it has Mr. Bustanti's name. And then it says the optionee, it designates them as the optionee. You see that on the front page?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only place that it designates the optionees.
So then the reference in the stock option is not to a defined term, but in fact to the actual person who owns the option.
That's correct.
So when we see optionee in here, we're talking about, in this instance, Mr. Bustanet.
That's correct. He's the optionee, and his ability to exercise his option term is governed right here on the backside of the option certificate under the terms and conditions. And when we look at this, the first thing is that there's no distinction between optionees. It doesn't matter how you acquired your option, you're an optionee. The second thing is that on this terms and condition, there is no change of control of the subsidiary provision. I think the parties agree there is nothing here. And so the only thing.
Well, what do we do with these words, pursuant to and subject to the provisions of the plan?
And surely we have to look at the plan. That's right on the front of the certificate.
Certainly we do. And as to the exercise of the options, we have to look to page 9 of the plan, because that specifically tells us about the exercise of the option. We got to keep in mind, Your Honor, that this plan governs two different employment plans. It's a bonus plan and a stock option plan, but the specifics of this particular plan that we're here about is what's on page 9. And that tells you about the exercise of options.
Okay, but I'm still not making the connection with the relevance of the argument you're making to the issue about the termination of these stock options.
And I'll get to that.
Okay.
Because right here's the issue, Your Honor. Because there's no change of control of the subsidiary, Monsanto has to say that this provision, 3A, they have to try to rewrite it into becoming a change of control of a subsidiary.
But while it doesn't talk about change of control of the subsidiary, both the plan on page 9 and the stock option at 3 in paragraph 3 talk about termination of the employment in the stock option with respect to the optionee, which is your client. So there is a triggering event that is mentioned, and it's the termination of employment. And the stock option incorporates by reference the definition in the plan for termination of employment. So why isn't that the key provision for us to be looking at to interpret both paragraph or part 3 of the plan and paragraph 3 of the option?
I agree that it is. And let's see what the termination of employment is required here. It says that this is under 3A now, if employment shall have been terminated by the company and its subsidiaries. So it requires, in my client's case, that there be a termination by Fisher, which never occurred.
Is Fisher Monsanto's subsidiary today?
No, it is not.
Well,
so when did Fisher stop being a subsidiary of Monsanto?
When it was sold to Emerson.
And that means as of that day, obviously, it's not its subsidiary under this agreement.
And I agree with that, but that's not what the plan says. It says if employment shall have been terminated, it requires a termination by Fisher of my employees. And to understand this, we've got to go back to the purposes of the plan.
Or can it also mean the discontinuation of employment with a subsidiary of Monsanto, and he is no longer employed by a subsidiary of Monsanto?
No.
Because Fisher is not a Monsanto employee. I mean, if you walk through the three definitions that are on Mr. Keltner's oral argument exhibit.
Well, actually, you can discern what they're meaning here if you read A, B, and C. And A, B, and C, they contemplate different ways in which somebody is terminated. B, because of disability, C, because of death, and A, because they no longer work at the company.
And that's exactly right. And that's like Judge Marable said in the lower court's opinion. We have to be mindful to give words their plain meaning. And termination, when you think of termination, if you see someone on the street and you say, and they come up to you and say, hey, I just got terminated from XYZ company, you don't think that the stock of XYZ company just got sold. You think he got fired.
But Mr. Hilden, I don't understand why we'd be looking at the common definition of termination when, in fact, it's a defined term in the plan and the option. And it means discontinuance of employment of a participant, and then you have to look elsewhere for the definition of participant and, in turn, eligible participant. Why are we looking anywhere but the definitions in the plan and the option?
But Your Honor, the definitions of participant and eligible participant weren't brought forward under the definition section. Termination of employment is, but not participant.
Well, but you can't read the definition of termination of employment in the plan without also reading the definitions that are incorporated into that definition, because participant is a capital P and a defined term. I mean, so you would have it. What then does participant mean in termination of employment, the definition, if we don't carry over the definition of participant for purposes of interpreting the option?
For discontinuance of employment, participant is going to still be subsumed under the termination of employment.
Right.
But eligible participant is not, Your Honor.
But in order to understand what participant means, it uses the defined term eligible participant with capitals. So in turn, don't you have to then read that definition to know what participant means so that you can know what termination of employment means?
No, Your Honor. If I could look at it this way, Your Honor. If it was just like Justice Abbott just said, you've got to look at this Section 3 as a whole. And it talks about actual terminations of employment. We're looking at termination of employment of the optionee. So we have to look at the optionee's employment status with its employer. And that's exactly what it does in 3C. It talks about death. In 3B, it talks about retirement or disability. And in 3A, there it is discussing whether a person is fired or quit because it requires termination by the subsidiary.
Why does Monsanto care about that? Why do they care that the subsidiary that it no longer owns, if it terminates the employee, the option should be shorter? Why do they care?
And that's a great question. Because the purpose of this plan is one plan to motivate both Monsanto and subsidiary employees. And subsidiary employees can't be motivated to work hard because it's a catch-22. The harder you work, the more attractive you make Fisher for sale, the more likely you are to lose your stock options. There's no incentive. And that's exactly why, true to the purposes of the plan, Monsanto made it here so that termination of employment would have to be by Fisher. That's why this is simply limited to on termination of employment of the optionee, not of the participant, but of the optionee.
Hey, let's look at this. We got to look at the whole thing. You don't want to look at B, but look at B here.
Yes, ma'am.
We're talking about disability. Under your reading, this is disability. It's hard for me to read in this type, but shall have been terminated by total and permanent disability as determined by the commission.
By the committee.
In the sole but unreasonable exercise of its judgment. Now, the committee is not going to be the committee of its new employer, is it? The committee means the Monsanto committee.
The committee as to what permanent disability is?
Let's suppose that your client, now employed by Fisher, 5 years down the line, he says, I'm totally and permanently disabled, and that plays into this B provision on how long the stock options last. And that total and permanent disability is to be determined by, quote, the committee. Now, does that mean the committee of who? Plainly, it means to me the committee of Monsanto, not of Fisher as sole.
I agree with that.
So you're saying that the committee of Monsanto now, for the next 10 years, will be making determinations of total or partial disability of a subsidiary that it sold 10 years ago.
And that's correct. And that's why that's the way Monsanto wrote the plan, but we've got to keep in mind that is the only way that Fisher employees could be motivated. That's the only way these stock options could motivate my class to work hard. And, Your Honor,
I don't think anybody here is arguing that the stock option applies to employees of subsidiaries of Monsanto. I don't think anybody's disputing that. It seems to me that's your argument, but as I understand, nobody disputes that. The question is, when the subsidiary no longer is a subsidiary, is that tantamount to termination? And so the argument you make about the incentive, it seems to me, works against you. If the subsidiary is cut out, so Monsanto no longer has employees at a Fisher subsidiary, it seems to me that it works against your argument because there is no incentive on the part of Monsanto to want Monsanto to have some competitive operation out there being incentivized to improve Monsanto stock.
No, but Your Honor, I think what that ignores, it ignores two things. It is, first of all, it's Monsanto's decision to sell Fisher. They know that they've tried to motivate these employees with a guarantee of a 10-year option term. So it's Monsanto's decision that they make in this case.
Well, it's your argument that I say it, that if Monsanto sells off of a subsidiary, that is not the same thing as terminating employment of the employees of that subsidiary. That's your argument.
It is not, because the plan under 3A requires that there be a termination by the subsidiary. And that's consistent with the purposes of the plan to
motivate. Well, it's not a subsidiary. No, nobody argues that the employee of the subsidiary. The whole issue here is this is no longer a subsidiary. So they weren't terminated by a subsidiary, but the subsidiary no longer exists. Was the fact that the subsidiary no longer exists tantamount to the people being terminated with respect to Monsanto?
No, because the plan requires that the only way their 10-year option terms can be reduced is if they are terminated by the company and its subsidiary. And they were never terminated by Fisher in this case.
Let me ask you three hypothetical questions. Let's assume that the definition of termination that we are going to apply in this case is the definition that's contained in the plan.
Correct.
Let's assume, secondly, that we construe that definition to mean that when it says discontinuous of employment, means that when Monsanto sold Fisher, Fisher was no longer a subsidiary, the plaintiff's employment with Monsanto was discontinued. Assume that. And assume one other thing with me, and that is the court construes the plaintiff in this case to be a participant. Assuming those three things, do you lose? And if not, why not?
If on your second hypothetical, let me make sure I got it correct.
Discontinuous of
employment. Is that discontinuance of employment equates to Monsanto selling Fisher?
And when Monsanto sold Fisher, the plaintiff in this case assumed that we construe that to mean that the plaintiff in this case was no longer employed in the Monsanto conglomerate. Okay, was no longer
yes,
employed. Okay, that satisfies what's written as discontinuance of employment. Okay?
Okay,
assuming that satisfies that phrase, do you lose? And if not, why not?
Well, Your Honor, you're correct. If you give it that interpretation, but it cannot be given that interpretation because the plan requires that the discontinuance of employment be from the subsidiary, which never occurred in this case.
What specific language do you point to reach that result?
All right. Number one is, there is nowhere in the plan or the option certificate a change of control of a subsidiary provision. Monsanto knew how to address that. It knew how to address the change of control over here. And to me, that's instructive here. When Monsanto's trying to bootstrap 3A into meaning change of control, it's instructive to us that we're going to use the ordinary meanings of the words here. And that requires the discontinuance of employment of my clients from the subsidiary, which never occurred.
Let me ask you this, approach it from a different direction, perhaps more policy-oriented or purpose-oriented about the contract, and that is, when the plaintiff was working for Fisher, and Fisher was a sub of Monsanto, the plaintiff had an incentive with regard to the options to do a good job, because the better job he did, the more money Fisher made, the more money Monsanto made, and the stock price went up, meaning his options were worth more.
Correct.
Once Fisher had been cut loose by Monsanto, there was no incentive at all for the plaintiff to do anything for Monsanto. No incentive to, in fact, he had no ability, in fact, to improve the value of the stock of Monsanto.
And if I can just show you where I think you're missing the point, is that these stock options were awarded to my clients based on their performance in the year before. It was based upon past performance. Whether they would get one option or 1,000 options or no option depended on their performance in the past year. So once Monsanto gave them that grant, from their hard work, they became optionees. Now, as to what in the future is Monsanto going to get from this? It is Monsanto's decision whether or not to sell Fisher or to keep Fisher. And Monsanto can keep Fisher, the subsidiary, and get all the benefits from my client's hard work, or they can make the decision in this case to make a tremendous profit because my clients had made Fisher so attractive for sale and sell it. But we've got to keep in mind that these grants of stock options were awarded based upon past performance.
Can we go back
and that's the summary judgment evidence.
Can we go back to the termination of employment and explore that for a little bit?
Yes, ma'am.
It added the phrase, it says, means the discontinuance of employment of a participant for any reason other than a transfer. And I assume that they included the words other than a transfer to have some meaning. Let's assume we took those words out. So termination of employment means a discontinuance of employment of a participant. It seems to me that if your client had taken another job within the Monsanto company without that qualifier for any reason other than a transfer, this plan would consider that a termination of employment, even though he was just now employed by a different Monsanto subsidiary.
Well, I would disagree with you in that I don't think there would ever be a discontinuance of employment by the company and its subsidiaries. They're still within the Monsanto.
But why did they put in the plan for any reason other than a transfer and then go to great pains to define what a transfer was?
Well, I think the reason, and to answer your question about the transfer, is that that's there so that, and it goes to the purposes of the plan. We want the optionees to get their full 10-year option terms to motivate them. So they want to be able to allow these people to transfer back and forth.
Right, but if you're under your theory, they wouldn't even need this because simply by, even if you sold the company, that termination employment has not been terminated because they are still employed by the same company that they were employed by when they got the stock option. So you don't, under your interpretation of the plan, you wouldn't need this qualifier because it wouldn't constitute termination employment.
I don't think that the phrase for any other reason than the transfer takes away the requirement that there has to be a termination of employment. I don't see how that works.
Doesn't that contemplate that transferring someone from one sub to another is a termination, even though they're within the company? Or otherwise, they wouldn't have had to qualify for any reason other than a transfer.
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think that is simply there just to demonstrate the purpose of the plan, that we don't want the people to lose a 10-year option term.
I see your time's up. Let me follow up with one question. Obviously, we've got some disagreement about what this term means. I mean, the Court of Appeals had one interpretation. We're looking at another. The parties have bitterly disputed it and filed extensive briefs on it. Isn't that the reason to put into the plan that the committee will make this determination? Do we have to find that Monsanto's position or the committee's position is unreasonable in order to rule for you?
The Monsanto has to carry their summary judgment burden that the interpretation is reasonable. Under Delaware law, that interpretation has to be reasonable.
So we would have to find that it's not reasonable as a matter of law in order to overturn the summary judgment, right?
And also, Your Honor, under Delaware law, the committee cannot stop the reasonable expectations of my client. And if you look in this case, first of all, the committee's interpretation does not follow anything in the plan.
Wait. Let me just make sure I have the terms right. Monsanto doesn't have to show that the committee's interpretation is reasonable to prevail. You would have to prove that it's unreasonable, correct?
In a summary judgment.
To defeat summary judgment, because it's within their discretion to determine it unless it's unreasonable.
No. Your Honor, first of all, under the section they quote in their exhibit there, it says that the interpretation has to be consistent with the provisions of the plan. It says that.
So we would have to find that their interpretation is inconsistent.
And it also, with regards to the exercise of stock options, that's going to be controlled on page 9 by 4B about what the committee can do to shorten the length of time in order to make the option term less than 10 years.
But you would agree that the committee may make this interpretation?
If it's consistent with the provisions of the plan.
And we would have to find it inconsistent in order to rule for you.
And in this case, under the facts, it would have to be inconsistent because...
Okay, well, I understand. We would have to find it inconsistent. I understand you say it is, but that would have to be our finding.
My point is, Your Honor, the committee didn't follow any language from the plan or the certificate. They said my clients were involuntarily terminated for reasons beyond their control from Monsanto. It had no... They knew there wasn't a change in control.
But we would have to accept your definition of what subsidiary means here in order to find for you.
That's correct.
Okay.
That there has to have been a termination of employment of the optionee by the subsidiary.
And we would have to find that is really the only reasonable interpretation of that provision.
Well,
we can't find, if it were ambiguous, we would have to rule for Monsanto.
If it were ambiguous or unambiguous?
Ambiguous.
If it's ambiguous, it's going to be a fact question.
Well, if it's ambiguous, doesn't the agreement give the authority to the committee to make that determination?
No, it has to be, it has to be consistent with the plan. And what we've got to keep in mind, Your Honor, here is that there is no provision that talks to the change of control of the subsidiary. They're simply trying to bootstrap this 3A because they forgot to address that provision.
So assuming they don't address it and we don't agree with your interpretation so that the agreement just doesn't really touch this situation top side or bottom, what about the provision on page 4 that says, a plan that says the committee shall have the exclusive right to interpret this incentive plan? Are you saying that we should not give effect to that? Are you saying it's void as against public policy?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying in the middle of that big, long paragraph there, it says that the interpretation has to be consistent with the provisions of the plan. That this committee was not given carte blanche to do what they want. In fact, this committee had some very tight restrictions on it. One, it had to be consistent with the provisions of the plan. And on page 9, it says that if you're going to make the option term less than 10 years, you've got to specify that time in the grant, and you've got to specify that triggering event.
But it also mentions the power. Doesn't it also say in that same paragraph that termination of employment, as shall have been determined by the committee, so they have the power to decide what constitutes termination of employment?
Right, and they have to specify it in the option, and that's what they did here under 3A, B, and C. That, see, their discretion, it isn't there. The plan's telling them, committee, you don't have this unfettered discretion. If you want to make the time period to exercise the options less than 10 years, then you've got to set it out here. And that's what 3A, B, and C are. That's exactly what the committee was doing.
Let me get back to my question on page 4. Do you think it's against public policy to give a plans committee the exclusive right to interpret the incentive plan?
I think it is because in this case, it goes against the reasonable expectations of my client, and Delaware law requires the committee not to go against the reasonable expectations. And that's to interpret it any other way would be against the purposes of the plan of motivating my clients, and it would be against this provision here that it is limited to termination of employment of the optionee. It looks at the optionee's employment status with its employer. That's all that you look at. Because if we're talking about Monsanto's status with regards to other companies, that's addressed over here in the change of control.
But we decide this is ambiguous, that it's just not clearly spelled out. Why shouldn't we say that the agreement controls, that all acts and decisions of the committee with respect to any question are binding?
Number one, because they have to be consistent with the provisions of the plan.
But if they're ambiguous, why shouldn't we then say, well, the parties have agreed that when there's ambiguity, at a minimum, when there's ambiguity, the plans, the committee controls?
Well, it doesn't say that anywhere in the plan. That if there is a provision that becomes ambiguous, that the committee
gets... It says that the committee's interpretation is final and binding.
If it's consistent with the provisions of the plan.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear rebuttal.
Mr. Keltner, to paraphrase what Mr. Hill has said, and I'm not sure that I'm doing it justice. Assume that Monsanto says we're having trouble recruiting employees for our subsidiaries because in this economic environment, holding companies are buying and selling subsidiaries right and left. We want to incentivize these employees to work for our subsidiaries, so we're going to give them a 10-year option to buy our stock. And because they're facing this risk that we may just sell the subsidiary and therefore not really want to work for them but rather work for us, we'll agree to let them have 10 years to exercise their option on our stock unless they're terminated by the subsidiary. And so what Mr. Held is saying, well, they went to work for a subsidiary, they get a 10-year option to exercise it, and there's a reason why that option arrangement does not talk about a transfer of ownership of the subsidiary. It's because that was a risk the employees, we wanted the employees to run, and to get them to work for that subsidiary, we agreed to give them 10 years to exercise the option on our stock. Why can't that be what this is all about?
Your Honor, I think you've raised two questions, maybe three with that, and let me address them. The issue on change of ownership is a false issue, and in fact, Justice Owen, in answering your question a minute ago, I think what you really were asking me was whether Section 7 of these option certificate trumped the termination of employment. The answer is no. 7 is only a vesting provision. 7's really in there for two reasons. It's a poison pill. It gives all the employees immediately vesting of their stock option, making it much more difficult for a takeover to occur.
Well, that was my question. If it's a poison pill, does that mean that even if they're terminated thereafter, they've got 10 years?
No. They have. If they're terminated, they have the period of time for termination under the option to exercise. You go ahead, it's just that 7 is merely a vesting. It doesn't give them an absolute 10-year right. And I think I misunderstood your question. Your Honor, though, in further answer to what you were saying, I think that's part of it regarding that. They did deal with the issue of termination. Even under 3A, which he talks about, it doesn't say the company and subsidiaries. It says the company, which is defined as Monsanto, and its subsidiaries. Totally different. When you no longer are an employee of a subsidiary of Monsanto, termination occurs. Next question I think you raised in your question, Your Honor, and I may be misreading it, and I hope not, is this. Is that another reasonable interpretation? I don't think so. But even if it were, was whether Section 7 of these option certificate trumped the termination of employment? The answer is no. 7 is only a vesting provision. 7's really in there for two reasons. It's a poison pill. It gives all the employees immediately vesting of their stock option, making it much more difficult for a takeover to occur.
Well, that was my question. If it's a poison pill, does that mean that even if they're terminated thereafter, they've got 10 years?
No. They have. If they're terminated, they have the period of time for termination under the option to exercise. You go ahead, it's just that 7 is merely a vesting. It doesn't give them an absolute 10-year right. And I think I misunderstood your question. Your Honor, though, in further answer to what you were saying, I think that's part of it regarding that. They did deal with the issue of termination. Even under 3A, which he talks about, it doesn't say the company and subsidiaries. It says the company, which is defined as Monsanto, and its subsidiaries. Totally different. When you no longer are an employee of a subsidiary of Monsanto, termination occurs. Next question I think you raised in your question, Your Honor, and I may be misreading it, and I hope not, is this. Is that another reasonable interpretation? I don't think so. But even if it were, given the powers given to the committee on page four, the committee was given the opportunity, the duty to interpret it, and it was final and binding on everybody. The question was asked, is that against public policy? No. This court in Newhall Brothers Packing addressed that issue and found that it is not violative of public policy, following a Dallas Court of Appeals decision in Bruner. Stemmerman from the Delaware Supreme Court says exactly the same thing. Interestingly, Stemmerman deals with Delaware law applied to Texas Instruments based in Dallas and interpreting stock options. And the question there was, Well, does a committee and the board of directors both, they both had duties of to interpret the plan, have the right to do that? And Delaware says yes. Delaware has never struck down a committee determination. He refers to one case, the plaintiffs refer to one case. It is a Connecticut case, Ellis. If you read Ellis, while it mentions Delaware law in one provision of the statement, it does not purport to apply Delaware law to that particular provision. In fact, it quotes law from Pennsylvania, Iowa, and California.
Well, I didn't hear your opposing counsel to say that it was against public policy. I heard your opposing counsel say it's just inconsistent with the plain terms. If we're back to the contract.
Yes, let me address that. I think it has to be reasonable under Delaware law. That is what Stimmerman says. And that's also what the Cooper case, which we cite to you, said. But reasonable means, I think, both consistent, and if there were an ambiguity, I think the committee certainly gets to make that decision. In this case, I don't think there's an ambiguity. The nice thing about this case is, since Delaware and Texas law are identical on contract construction, it being, one, a question of law, two, from the face of the document, and three, I think, most importantly, reading the whole document together and trying to harmonize the provisions, as the Delaware Supreme Court did in DuPont, in this case, then this court continually tells folks to do, it is clear. The one thing that is absolutely true in termination, and everybody agrees, that termination terminates the right to exercise the option. No one disagrees with that. And as a result of that, the termination is termination from a Monsanto-related company.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Thank you. That concludes the arguments in today's clauses. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All right.